Welcome to Great Photography, a podcast all about the creative side of photography. This is Daniel Sieg. In today's episode, I will have a conversation with Annette Lang, or maybe pronounced more correctly, Annette Lang. Annette Lang is a German-born street photographer living in Nice, France. Ever since she was young, she has been fascinated by observing people in everyday life situations, trying to make sense of their actions and to understand how they relate to their environment. Annette is a member of the Women Street Photographers, and her work has been exhibited internationally. Well, Annette, welcome to Create Photography. I'm very excited to speak with you today.
Thank you very much, Daniel. I'm very happy to be with you.
All right. So, Annette, I've read that you are fascinated by observing people in everyday life situations, trying to make sense of their actions and to understand how to relate to their environment, and that this fascination took you into studying anthropology and cultural linguistics. Can you tell me more? I'm curious about your studies.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, it actually is true. So I've always had a special passion for languages, and it was always fascinating when I was a child to see children of other cultures speaking another language so fluently, whereas I was unable to do so. And that first took me to cultural linguistics. And from there, as a second subject, I took anthropology because I was kind of obsessed with the idea of that people make different sense of either the same or different environments. And it was very interesting for me how people reacted in very different ways to the same input, that the same thing could mean so many different things. And how they actually try to make the best of the physical environment they live in. And so that's what I studied, and my specialization was intercultural communication, intercultural sense making.
Oh, wonderful! And so, where did you study? Where did you study?
I studied in Germany first, and then I got a study grant for Lyon in France, and that took me to Lyon. And then from then on, I never left France for my studies. I just, went on year after year, sort of being more at ease with the French system, strangely. And also back in time, also there was a huge difference in recognition of degrees. So when I took my first year in France, I obtained what is now a bachelor degree, but back then in Germany, there was no such thing as a bachelor degree. You could have your basic studies, which was called Grundstudium, or you could actually have a master's degree, but there was nothing in between. Mm-hmm. And once I caught in that non-recognition, I actually stayed. And I discovered that I actually felt very much at home in France. And so later on, there were personal choices, like having my children here, going briefly back to Germany in 2000, but coming back in 2001.
Yeah, and that's a nice lead-in, actually, to one of my next questions. So I'm, like you, an immigrant or emigrant, depending on your point of view. and so, one of the things I noticed, it is a huge cultural difference between countries and geographies and, for example, how much people are observing each other or not observing each other. So I think in the US it's less of a, people are less observing. It's not that they're not, but like in Switzerland, I noticed, people are very much observing. so it seems to be an interesting difference. I don't know, I grew up in Basel and around Basel, Switzerland, but so I don't know if that's a difference between growing up in a smaller town or not. But anyway, so I guess my question to you, have you observed something like that for your transition? And, you grew up in rural Germany. Have people been more observing each other maybe there? And has that influenced you in some way?
I think that's an excellent question. I think there was, or there is, a huge difference. Well, but I'm not sure you can pin it down to it being France and Germany, or is it, as you just hinted at, is it more about being a smaller village and a bigger village? So I really grew up in a small village, and I hated that feeling of constantly being not so much observed than judged. You know, everybody was constantly updated on who was doing what or was not doing what. And if what people were doing was consistent or not with written or unwritten rules. And I found that very limiting. And moving to a big town in France was liberating for me. And, you know, when you are an immigrant or immigrant, you have a different zone in which you move in terms of you're discovering the rules. So you are actually breaking rules, but without knowing. And it takes some time before you actually understand you are breaking rules. So, yes, I think it's there is a huge difference to what extent people look at each other, observe each other, to what extent that observance is actually tolerated. You know, there are so many different verbs that actually describe you. You've got looking, but looking is very different from staring at or staring down or scrutinizing. And it's interesting if you try to see where the different semantic rules run in between these different terms. For instance, I mean, staring is very clearly negatively connotated, whereas in looking at is more neutral. And well, I actually really love sitting in a place and observing people. And I think one cultural difference is the way seatings are arranged in a French, in contrast to a German cafe. So if you go to a French cafe, all chairs are arranged in a way that everybody can look out onto the street. So it's really arranged in a way that it makes easy for people. You would never have that in Germany. People would, I mean, seating would be arranged in a way that people are looking at each other sitting in the cafe. So I think you really pointed out at something very important. So apparently observing people here in France is kind of a normal thing to do. Whereas in Germany, people do, but in a more, you can say it, subtle or a more indirect way.
Yeah, it's almost like in France, you can say it's part of the normal culture. I remember going to Paris. Paris is close to Switzerland and, you know, Germany too, of course, but I always enjoy just sitting in a cafe and just observing, you know, people passing by and observing life. So I think it is just kind of maybe it part is. Of the cultural fabric.
It is, you know, and for me, there's a huge difference between, you know, observing and judging.
Yeah, yeah.
well, I mean, you do speak German, so you need the German word of less than, which cannot be translated. I even wrote an article about the untranslatability of that term, which actually consists in saying something negative about a third person not present in the current discussion. It's a bit like bitching, but it is not necessarily that negative in German than in English, because bitching is very clearly female. Whereas I'm not sure less than is that female. I think it has a tendency to be more female too. But, you know, for me, there's a huge difference in just observing or making comments, and especially depreciative comments about people you're seeing. Right. And that is something I took into my photography, saying, okay, I'm observing people. I'm even photographing it. But I don't want it to be negative. I don't want it to be pointing out at it negative things for people or exposing them. For me, there's a huge difference between observing, photographing, and then exposing.
Right. And so you are fascinated by the observation of everyday life situations. So when did this fascination lead you into photographing people and, you know, people in their surroundings and so forth? When did you get into that?
It hasn't been a direct line. There have been different stages in my life when I went to and away from cameras. My first experience was when I went to India when I was 16. And it was a huge culture shock. I wanted to go to India, and my parents allowed me to go. And I stayed with an Indian family. But I mean, the life around me was so different, and there were so many situations that looked shocking to my middle class eyes from rural Germany. And so I actually used a camera to be my shield in between what I was seeing, what I was not really grasping, which shocked me and got to me. And the camera shielded me from that feeling of being overwhelmed. So I really photographed a lot, and that set a bit the tracks to my doing photography, mostly when I was abroad and not in my own cultural context, that lasted for very long years. And then I sort of gave up photography, and then I started into binge photographing my own sons, which is not, I mean, of course, very precious photos to me, but I think in terms of photography, they're not worth anything much. And so then photography, instead of turning the lens at people I did not know, I exclusively turned the lens to my own children, which was a very intimate use of the camera. Mm-hmm. And then I came back. I mean, it went back to traveling, you know, to actually taking photos when traveling. And I have only been into street photography in the proper sense of the term for one year and a half. So actually, there was a huge obstacle for me in saying, okay, I'm actually photographing my direct environment. I sort of either needed the intimate relationship with my children or the anonymous relationship with people in a place that was my own. And saying, okay, I'm part of the society, and that part of a society I'm documenting, I'm photographing what I see, was a huge step.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about consistency, so shifting gears a little bit. One of the things I noticed from your Instagram feed actually is what I would call consistency. So consistency in style and subject, perhaps generally speaking, and then maybe more specifically in colors. So maybe first, let's start with the general questions. What are your thoughts about consistency?
I think consistency, as far as I'm concerned, came to me, not so much as myself actively trying to build it up.
Mm-hmm.
I had read about lots of things when I started Instagram. I mean, starting Instagram was more or less a bit of a joke, and so I didn't know anything about Instagram before starting, you know, posting things. And then people started, you know, telling me I should either do a color or black and white, or I should do this or that, or not animals or animals, or exclusively animals or whatever it was. And I couldn't identify with that at all. Mm-hmm. And then finally I came through to color photography when I realized that what I was doing in black and white was just extremely bad, you know, seeing what real black and white photographers did. I said, oh, okay, actually I'm not seeing the world in black and white, so I cannot photograph it in black and white because my vision is very clearly color focused. So color came first in terms of consistency. And then came actually the lockdown. And the lockdown limited how far I could move. And the promenade until then had not at all been on my photographic radar. Actually, for me, it was a touristy place, and I didn't see much interest of going on to the promenade. And then suddenly the promenade became my little realm of freedom and the only one I had. Because if you go into the old town and everything's closed, it's not very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly what I started, I was seeing those patterns. You know, I saw that there wasn't much on the promenade. I mean, there's the horizon and the mostly blue sky. And it was a brilliant canvas and observing what people were doing and how they identified, especially with those chairs, the blue chairs. And what started being interesting to me is not so much who was in the picture as an individual person, but how people as society behaved, arranging themselves around a given place, making sense for them at that moment in time. One very clear indicator was the distance. You know, these chairs are rifted to each other, so you cannot move them around. So they are arranged in a fixed line. And your only way to twist around with your own feeling of comfort was to choose how many seats you wanted to leave empty.
Mm-hmm.
And that came alongside with a more detailed thinking about exposing people without their consent. So moving away a bit from showing people's faces which was parallel to the fact that anyway people were wearing masks. So you see this consistency actually was a mixture between external environment changing, rules changing, in my own way of positioning myself with regard to that changing environment, those changing rules.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about color a little bit. You hinted at that already, and I think that relates to consistency as well. Your color palettes look very consistent. And is that something you're doing more deliberately? For example, I do see quite a bit of cyan, blue, greens, or maybe just blues as well in your images. Is, you know, first of all, do you agree with that? Do you agree with that, that you kind of, you have a certain line of colors in your work? And is that something, again, that you're doing maybe more consciously?
That would be yes and no.
Mm-hmm.
I do not create colors artificially in the sense I'm not replacing colors. I quite often desaturate the blue a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But if the blue is gray, then I do not replace a gray sky with a blue color palette. So my editing is actually just, you know, giving a varnish to what I have. So why blue? I mean, the blue actually comes with my direct environment being, you know, the promenade, looking out onto the Mediterranean. So that is a lot of blue because you've got the sky, and the sky here is quite often blue, and the chairs happen to be blue. Right. So actually, it really was not, I only want to do blue. I'm actively living for blue. What happens is I have a very color-focused vision in the sense of I immediately spot color coincidences or color matches. So it's not something... Mm-hmm. So this is why I sometimes feel like an imposter when people say, oh, amazing color match. And I feel like I'm taking credit for something I naturally see. And there isn't much merit in seeing it. So, I'm a bit obsessed. I would never wear colors, for instance, that do not match when I'm dressing. Mm-hmm. And very important color memory. So I really memorize colors very well. And I had that very early on. At some point in my life, I lost color vision, 80% of my color vision due to a disease. And after that, I had to retrain color vision. And I had those little cubes, which I had to arrange according to color families. And it took me some time to actually get back to it. And so this natural predisposition of seeing color matches became very valuable to me because I had lost it for some time and I had to rebuild it. And this is why I don't like noise. So for instance, I'm very sensitive to how much sound is in my environment. For instance, I nearly never have surrounding music. And when I have too many colors in my frame, it feels like noise, visual noise to me.
Mm-hmm.
So which is quite often why I, I'm more naturally spot frames that do not hold so many different colors.
Right. Yeah, something I noticed. That's very interesting to hear you talk about that. Yeah. And you live at the Côte d'Azur. So
I do.
So I guess, right, the Azur meaning maybe sky blue could be one translation. I don't know if it's
one translation. And as I said, it really started with that lockdown because I have, you know, tried to pull back into the more urban environment in Nice I have a lot of shots also from the town. I mean, what I post on Instagram is not the extent of what I actually photograph.
Right. Course,
and there's one thing that is very important for me is to actually giving back to the society or to the community I evolve in. And Nice has a very tightly knit social network in the old town with still lots of little shops. And quite often I take shots for them and I give it to them. For instance, last Saturday they did a fashion show, they did a catwalk, you know, different merchants actually, you know, organized a sort of impromptu catwalk, and they asked me if I could take the photos for free, and of course I did. So I've got lots of shots like these where I actually photograph people either because they ask me to or because I've got candid ones. But it doesn't always feel right to actually expose. It doesn't build a story that is Instagrammable in the sense of it would make sense for people beyond just seeing one person in the shop or seeing people shopping. So I'm a bit struggling with, you know, pulling that together to a consistent, so here we are again, a consistent story and saying, okay, I'm telling another story, which is not just, you know, people on the market or I'm struggling with translating the feeling I'm getting from the old town into a consistent Instagram feed right now.
I read in one of your interviews the following, which I thought was interesting. Don't care about technique and do care about technique. Of course, this sounds paradoxical, but I think I understand what you mean. Would you mind elaborating on this?
No, not at all. Well, actually, I think it's quite often I'm taken aback by people asking what camera I use or what lens I use or what my settings are. And I think technique for me is a means. Knowing the technique of your camera, or at least some of the features, is the means to actually being able to translate what you're seeing into a photo. For instance, I think things like depth of field or motion blur or what else can I say? White balance. All of those are for me expressive means. So I want to know them so I can use them like a brush when I'm actually making a photo. Because in German, you make a photo, you don't take a photo, you make it.
Right.
So you actually, you make it.
Right.
my photo. But for me, it's never important to, I would never put that technique over seeing the situation. So instance, I wouldn't walk around and say, okay, today I want to make shallow depth of field, or today I want to play with speed. So quite often when I go out with more or less, I work on aperture priority. That's what I'm most often use. And very exceptionally, I twist it to speed priority if the situation demands it. So I want to understand those elements so I can use them in a meaningful way. And this is why I say don't care about technique, saying, okay, for me, it's not going out and saying, okay, today I want to do, I absolutely want to do that. That's not what I'm doing. But at the same time, you need to know, it's like when you cook. You know, when you cook, you want to have taste in your plate in the end, and you want it to look good or to taste good or to convey a certain feeling.
Right.
But it's not so much about, or, you know, sauteing. I wouldn't say, okay, I want to do something sauteed or something fried. It's a technique I need to know so I can make that meal. For me, that's the same. So I think it's important sometimes to just say, to really get into your camera and understand how it works, because every camera has different strong points and weak points.
Right.
And
right.
If you don't know them, you're going to be limited when you're out, or you're going to be frustrated because you see somebody else's work and you want to reconstruct that, but maybe you're not using the same material. And so maybe you cannot exactly reproduce it. And so you're actually building frustrations by yourself. So for me, it's, you need to know technique so that you can actively use them. But if you are not a technique person, you can still make fantastic photos. For me, it's eye over material, eye over equipment, very clearly.
Right. What is your process in street photography, if I can call it that, or maybe approach? Do you, when you go out, is it more of an intuitive, spontaneous approach for you? Or is it something you have a certain plan, perhaps, or a certain goal in mind?
It is a mix of the two of them. So I'm quoting another photographer who's called Adrian Ware, who's from Melbourne. He's Atamo on Instagram. And I heard him say in a conference that he is actually going for a walk and he's taking the camera with him. And when he doesn't get a nice photo, he still had a nice walk. And that's really something that inspired me, because at some point I had this sort of obsessive wish, I'm going out and I need to get a great photo. And I was so actively observing that I lost all the pleasure of just being outside and walk. And to cure that obsession, I actually went back to walking without taking the camera, just seeing, just observing, for the very pleasure of just seeing And then saying, okay, and this is why I'm very often saying I learned most of the photos I didn't take, because I saw something and at that moment I did not have my camera with me, but it prepared me of if ever a similar or another situation was exposed to me, I would be able to take it. And I once read in a book, or I read in several books actually, that you are not a real street photographer if you do not always have your camera with you.
Okay.
Well, so then I'm not a real photographer because I do not always have my camera with me, and I don't want to have my camera constantly with me. And I had reached a point when I was quite unsufferable for people who went out with me, because I was constantly, you know, either, you know, jogging towards something or flexing down or saying, oh, that's a great photo, I have to take it, and not following any conversational stream. And I said, okay, so when I'm going out, I really say, now I'm going on a walk and I'm taking my camera because I would like to take photos. And it's not meditative, it's very contemplative, really saying, okay, I'm just observing. And when I see something, I'm a very spontaneous shooter. So I'm completely unable to stand at a spot and to wait for the situation. I am totally unable to do that. First of all, I'm quite impatient. And I feel when I'm standing at a certain place and just waiting for the perfect situation to, you know, happen under my eye, I'm losing so many other situations that might be happening around me and that I'm not seeing because I'm just concentrating to one thing to happen. So I tried that. It doesn't work for me at all. So I just walk for never more than 2 hours, actually. I do not have the concentration to have that level of observation. And I observe and I go. You know, I'm trying to observe what's happening around me and I shoot. But again, I never shoot in burst mode. I'm a single shot person. So I never come home having 400 shots and finally only having 5. I think my frustration threshold is too low for that. I mean, I would actually feel very discouraged. So what does happen is that I do go out and I come home and I didn't really take many photos. And then you have those moments. I had a great moment on Saturday when I actually could shoot a rickshaw that had a flamingo float attached to its roof. And then sometimes you have those moments. It just happens. Right. And then you were lucky and you were there and you could click it.
Yeah.
But I think street photography for me is about humility. You might or you might not be at the right spot at the right moment. And you should feel, I wouldn't say blessed because, of course, it sounds religious and it's not about religion. But I think you should really be very conscious of the fact that you can be very lucky and sometimes you just not. And sometimes, yes, you have to have that eye open so that you give luck the possibility to come to you.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a great point. And I actually spoke with another photographer, and Alan Burles, and he mentioned, he calls it the given moments. So these moments are sometimes perhaps given to us. And that's, again, not meant to be religious at all. It's just that concept of, yeah, sometimes you're lucky, right, to your point.
And what you need to have for me is that openness of, for me, it's really, you know, you have to open all openings, your mind, your ears, your smell, your touch, I wouldn't call it soul again because it sounds a little bit, you know, over the top. But you need to be completely open and let your environment in so that you can actually spot that moment. And to have that opening, for me, I cannot walk with other people. So I really need to be on my own and to say, okay, now I'm doing this and I'm enjoying to be so much tuned into my environment. For me, it's really, you know, being tuned in. And then sometimes it happens and sometimes it does not. Humility, I think it is.
I read in one of your interviews that the laws, and shifting gears again here a little bit, with regards to street photography in France are quite strict. Kind of interesting, you know, maybe first to some of us as we're traveling to other countries, including France or Paris. Could you elaborate on that some more, please?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, the legal situation is that you were not allowed to publish photos of people without their consent. And people can even object to being photographed without their consent. So okay. That is the legal situation. So if you have a look at French Instagram feeds, I think 95% of what we are posting is illegal. So that is okay. The legal situation. And then for me comes a moral stance towards that, saying, okay, so quite often now I post in a way that makes people unrecognizable because they're taken from the back. If I show people's face it, that at some point I have interacted with them. So I do not ask beforehand because for me it destroys the show. Mm-hmm. You know, it's actually walking towards someone and saying, okay, you look great, can I take your photo? For me, it takes away the candid part and with that, the gist of it all. So what I do quite often when the situation feels right, I do it right after it, you know, walking towards people. But this means that people are not socially engaged with somebody else. I would never interrupt people, you know, conversing, saying, okay, I just photographed you. It would feel too intrusive for me. What I do quite often, because Nice is a small city, I see people again. And then quite often I walk to them and say, you know, some days ago or some weeks ago, I actually took your photo. And by then I have it on my phone and I can show it to them. And then I really actually suggest, do you want me to send it to you or do you want to have it, you know, deleted? It happened last week when I had photographed an Asian lady sitting on the blue chairs conversing with her baby in a stroller. It was such a beautiful situation. I was wondering if she was a tourist because I hadn't seen her before. Of course, I don't see everybody, but sometimes you have a feeling that you have already seen somebody before. And I really wanted to run into her to show her the photo, and I finally did. And I ran into her another day and I showed her the photo. And of course, it's a risk because when you're doing that, you actually tell people I took your photo without your consent.
Right, right.
And I was lucky again because she was totally over the moon because on that day when I met her, it was her baby's first birthday. And she felt it was a birthday present that I actually said, okay, I have your photo. Do you want me to send it to her? And we exchanged for some, you know, some messages on WhatsApp even after that. Mm-hmm. So I think, well, maybe it's I'm just creating a discourse to make my own stance right. But I have the impression that what you feel about people and the respect you hold for people flows into your photo and somehow shows.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make it legally right, but it, I mean, it gives value to what I call street ethics, street photography ethics. Right. So it is, right. I would not expose people in a way that makes people laugh about them. So things like fat shaming or somebody's skirt that actually is blown up by the wind, or I've got those photos sometimes, but I do not post them.
Mm-hmm.
I have them because it happened when I was taking the photo. I have a photo of a lady with a very short skirt and her skirt is blown up and you see her, you see her backside. It actually is a beautiful photo because she is quite generous in her body form, but she looks very beautiful on that photo. But I think it would not be received as that on Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
And since I cannot control how people receive a photo, I'm steering clear of taking the risk of exposing her, of making her feel exposed, even if you cannot recognize her. Mm-hmm. So that would be my stance. So I had that discussion some time ago with another photographer moving from another country to Tunis, and she was very used to taking photos on the beach. And I said, I really highly recommend not doing it here because on the beach, people are not very clothed. That is why they're going to the beach. And if you take photos on the beach, try to make sure it's not in a way of you know, yeah, I mean, intruding into their intimacy. I've got some beach shots, and I also have beach shots of people that are not very dressed. So it's not a clear yes or no. It always is about, for me, how, under what circumstances, what do you do with it, what does it feel? And that you need to be extra sensitive to how you do it, more than saying very clearly yes or no.
Right, right. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, thanks. Very, very great nuanced answer on that topic. I think it's I think it's not a simple thing, right? I mean, as always, ethics, there are a lot of gray zones, but I think a lot of it has probably to do with, you know, what feels right and what you want to have done to yourself as well.
And, you know, recently a restaurant owner asked me if I could take some photos for his Instagram feed. And he wanted, because he had actually hired a professional photographer, but he wasn't happy about that because he said it felt feels too cold because the professional photographer had only photographed the meals, you know, the dishes. And I said, well, you know, the problem is I can take mood photos of your restaurant, but you're running into legal problems because people might not want to be exposed on your Instagram feed. And talking about restaurants in a place like Nice, there might it might happen that people are sitting at the same table who are not supposed to be sitting together at the same table. And I mean, so it, it can have just, you know, giving him posting a photo on Instagram can have quite, I mean, I wouldn't call it dramatic, but quite unpleasant consequences for people. So you are throwing them out into that. And that really is something that, so I thought, well, I can do, but either we make people come over to your restaurant on purpose and taking photos then, and people know that they're going photographed and it's a bit fake. But it really is something you need to remember if you're photographing people in Nice.
Let's talk about composition for a little bit. Another thing I noticed in your photography is that you have quite a nice sense of geometry and symmetry. Your foregrounds are often occupying a small portion of the frame. You have kind of a parallel horizon. You use leading lines, but maybe not as often. So how is your approach to composition? And do you, again, similar question as previously, do you think about this deliberately for some of your photographs?
I actually thought about it deliberately in the sense of, I know I'm quite often breaking rules, like the rule of thirds and, you know, the kind of thing.
I like that.
I personally don't, for me, the rule of thirds doesn't look right for me quite often. For me, it's, it's not what is the most beautiful for me. I think I'm kind of inspired by Japanese aestheticism, in the sense of, in a Zen garden, what is beautiful is not the stone or the second stone, but the space you leave empty between them. And so for me, emptiness is an important part of composition. It's not so much what is in there than what is not in there. So that leaving room to, I don't know what, leaving breathing room. So that is one part of, and this actually leads to quite of not applying the rule of thirds. But then once another photographer on Instagram at the very beginning, he said to me, you have to make sure your verticals are right. And he was very right on, I actually didn't pay enough attention to the fact that straight lines should be straight. And from there on, I really made sure I have either a very clearly vertical line or very clearly horizontal line, which actually limits the use of wide angle quite often, because wide angles, of course, quite often crush the lines. So, yes, for me, it's important to have space and to not to have too many elements. So I've got, I think I've got a naturally minimalistic approach, but which also reveals that I'm extremely bad at layering. So I just, my eye right now isn't able to see it. You know, having lots of several actions happening at the same time on different levels, I'm very admirative when I see people doing that. I said, okay, I would have seen that or that. It sometimes happens, but quite often it's more, I'm lucky. I actually was concentrating on one thing and something else happened in the background, and I was lucky to get it. Not so much as I consciously composed it. So I think my vision is quite often maybe even simplistic. That I only see one thing and I try to create room for that one thing. So I think it's more the lack of skills on my side than a specific skill.
Well, that's maybe humility, but that's... but I understand. But and that makes sense with what you described with the negative space, which is also an interesting element.
And it always makes me fun when I see this negative space thing. For me, it is not negative. You know, it's very positive.
Right.
But well, I know that in photography speak, right. It is. And I get
they
that comment quite
yeah,
often.
I didn't mean it negative in it. Yes, I know what you mean. Yeah. Yeah. Right. It's not negative in that sense.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, but I mean, it wasn't correcting you. Yep. It was just, you know, it's something I just I often smile when I get that comment saying, oh, actually, I'm not getting it. I'm the one not getting it because I don't have the impression of using negative space, just space and emptiness. As
it is just space.
It.
Yeah, that's good. It's actually good. Yeah, I haven't thought about it in that connotation. Yeah, that's actually really interesting. Well, anyway, how we use that word, right? Because you're absolutely right. It is not negative. In fact, it is overall is probably something. Yeah, we shouldn't probably give it a negative word. but anyway. Yeah, you know, a question I often ask street photographers is the following. What advice would you give photographers who are just starting out in photography, maybe with regards to, you know, how to approach it in particular?
I would actually recommend staying small in the sense of choosing one specific place that has a specific meaning for them. And going back to the same place over and over to see if you are able to spot the differences in a given setting. Because I remember from myself, I had the impression I constantly had to be everywhere at the same time. And when I was turning right, I could muse over half an hour that it would have been better if I had turned left. And so I think I would say, okay, you choose a place in which you feel comfortable shooting because, I mean, physically speaking, you've got the space, you can step back or go forward. You've got light. That is what you want to have is light. And try to concentrate on what's happening. Mm-hmm. And for me, concentrating on what's happening is easier in places that are not overloaded with lots of different elements. So I would rather, you know, go to a place that is naturally emptier than naturally filled. But again, that is my approach to it. Mm-hmm. And I would say, okay, watch. Go there the day before you actually shoot or the hour before you actually shoot. And don't shoot. Just go and watch. Go and watch and act as if you had a camera without actually taking it out. And then, well, yes, go and take your camera out. And I would really recommend not to care about technique at the very beginning. Whatever camera makes great photos. And if you have a look at Patty Jensen, who often says that she has a bad camera, but she has a truly amazing eye.
Yes.
And she for me is one of the best examples of just stop caring about all this talk about equipment. Have a look at what Patty is able. I don't know what camera she has, but she herself says it's not a good one, but that she has the most amazing eye. And I think that is a huge part of street photography is, you know, feeling a place, feeling comfortable in it, and then just let go.
Mm-hmm.
Let go. I would, well, I know, again, I'm extremely against what people constantly repeat, and I'm sure they are right. But I wouldn't watch too many books, and I wouldn't start looking at photos of the big masters.
Right.
Because it's frustrating. I mean, it's if you take people like Cartier-Bresson, it was a completely different historical context. It was a very different societal approach towards photography and photos and pictures and images. So people were much less concerned. It was a completely different era. Then if you take masters like Alan Challa, they're completely out of reach.
Mm-hmm.
Try to define for yourself what you feel when you see somebody's photos. And then do not try to do exactly the same. I think inspiration is one thing, imitation is something different. And imitation, for me, in the long run, is going to limit yourself.
Yeah.
And then once you have started shooting, then take back and look at photos, you know, but it has to be for me doing it and looking at photos. It has to be a mix between the two of them. I would just, change the initial point of not starting with big masters, but with people that you feel are approachable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great. And that is why, for me, Instagram is a great thing. I know it's criticized for lots of different things, and maybe there are lots of criticisms to be made. But when it comes to finding source of inspiration, you've got all kinds of inspiration. And many people actually really, I mean, react when people reach out to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very true. Wonderful. Well, so my last question is, where can people best find you and your work?
Oh yeah, as I'm only an amateur photographer, so far the only place where you can find us, I'm afraid, is on Instagram. I have been exposed in certain exhibitions. I will be exposed this year in Treviso. There is a great there's the first Swedish street photography festival to happen in Gothenburg from the 17th to the 19th of September.
Oh, nice.
I have the big honor and pleasure. I was invited to give a conference. So I think I will talk about what I'm doing. So my work will be there. I mean, I will be talking about my work, and there are also four competitions I would invite everybody to participate in. So I don't have a website. Maybe it makes you laugh, but I never considered myself as important enough to have my own website. So I am considering building one, but
okay.
I've got this hesitation doing it that I feel like I don't really deserve it. So, I mean, it's, yeah. So far you can find me on Instagram. This is where you can find me and on the occasional exhibition.
If you can give us the Instagram handle. That would be great.
Yeah, the Instagram handle is Luxtasia. It's like Fantasia, but Lux for light at the very beginning. Okay. So Luxtasia, it's Luxtasia. That's where you can find me.
Okay, wonderful. Well, Annette, thank you so much again for speaking with me today. It was truly a pleasure.
It was a very reciprocal pleasure, Daniel.
All right, this wraps up my conversation with Annette Lang from Nice in France. I hope you enjoyed it. As always, you can find the show notes at danielsigphotography.com/episode046. And if you want to support the show, please do so at danielsigphotography.com/podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you next time.